Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
And we're staying at his house during South by Southwest playing music. I said, hey, Ethan, the sink's leaking. He walked in, just pulled it like right out of the wall. I was like, what did you do that for? We could have. He's like, well, it's broken now, and now the landlord has to fix it. It'll get done right.
That was like a cosmic truth for you.
In various different ways, till I was able to open a restaurant.
Today, we are talking to chef and restaurateur Andy Ricker, who has introduced many Americans, including me, to the joys and pleasures of Northern Thai food in his many iterations of his group of pop-pock restaurants, first in Portland, Oregon, and now in Brooklyn. Andy grew up in Vermont and fell in love with Thai culture and cuisine on his very first trip there in 1987. He ended up spending several months of every year thereafter in Thailand before opening the first Pok Pok in what was essentially an old dilapidated house in an unfashionable section of Portland in 2007. Andy's passion and expertise about Northern Thai food captured the hearts and minds of serious eaters and chefs alike. In 2011, he won the James Beard Award for Best Chef Northwest. His book, aptly named Pok Pok, Food and Stories from the Streets, Homes, and Roadside Restaurants of Thailand, is not just a terrific cookbook. It's also a deep and very personal dive into Thai food and culture. Here to talk about Thai food and culture, the whole concept of authenticity, and how he feels about being the face of Thai food in America is Andy Ricker. So great to see you, Andy.
Hey, thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me.
And first, let me say that you have introduced more unfamiliar and wonderful dishes and flavors to me than probably any other chef in the last few years.
That's amazing to hear.
it's true, and I thank you for that, my friend.
Well, I appreciate you. Appreciate you saying it.
So tell us about life at the Ricker family table in Vermont.
Okay. My mom was a good cook. Still is a good cook.
Like solid, down-the-middle American cook?
No. I was raised by hippies, Ed. And my mom, we always had a garden, you know, and we always shopped at the co-op. And
that's redundant, hippies and co-op.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, lots of unsalted chunky peanut butter and bulgur wheat and, you know, stuff like that. But she's also a fantastic baker. And she made all our bread. And she'd make this fantastic whole wheat bread. And she'd use she'd make different size loaves. I think it probably because we didn't have enough bread pans. So she'd start using coffee cans. And I remember the folks used to drink Medaglia d'Oro. I remember that.
Sure.
Before the current.
Before the hipsters.
Yeah, took over coffee.
Bombed onto it.
You know, you make a blend of Medaglia d'Oro and something else. And that was the coffee. So we also had these Medaglia d'Oro coffee cans laying around. She'd make the bread in that. So
wow.
We would always have fresh baked bread, and we would cook pretty simply, not a lot of, you know, big protein-heavy meals because we were also a little bit poor. So we were kind of living off of what was available at the food co-op and what, you know, we'd get at the garden and at the local Safeway. So
Was there cannabis involved in the bread baking?
Not directly in the bread, but the baker for sure. and that kind of carried over to dinner as well. So, you know, we'd have things like my mom would make like a few things that were kind of her dishes that she did. And then she'd experiment a lot. So she used to make a really fantastic mac and cheese with wheat germ crust on it. I remember that really vividly. It was quite good. And we, you know, we're close to Cabot Creamery, so we'd get this beautiful cheese from Cabot Creamery, and she'd make this baked mac and cheese casserole thing. And then there was something. She comes from a family, a Northern Italian family, and she would make this soup. I remember it really. These are the two dishes that I remember most clearly from my childhood is the mac and cheese. And then a soup that was meatballs in a chicken broth with spinach and
Italian
egg drop.
Wedding soup.
Right, exactly. And I never knew the name of it. I just knew it as the soup that mom made. And I can taste it right now just thinking about it. And I haven't had it for, I don't know, probably 20 or 30 years, but I still can remember how it tastes.
Wow, that's crazy. So did you gravitate to the kitchen and were you interested in the food she was cooking, and was dinner a kind of meaningful moment in the family?
Yes. I mean, we were, we lived in rural Vermont, and we didn't go out for dinner. And so, we definitely, dinner was the central kind of endeavor in the evening. Come home from school, do your chores. At some point, one of the chores was either doing the dishes or cooking dinner. And I hate doing the dishes. I've always hated doing the dishes. And so, like, I made a beeline to volunteer to cook, even though I didn't know what I was doing. I think I figured out how to make hamburger glop, we used to call it. It was just, burger and a can of tomatoes and
right. It was hamburger something. Helper without the package shit.
Exactly, yeah. So macaroni boiled, and that was kind of my thing. That was my specialty. But yeah, dinner was very much a gathering of the family. And, sometimes it would be something very simple. Other times it would be, a little bit more bounteous than that. But it was, we were raised, we weren't allowed to have like bologna or Jiffy.
Really?
Nothing like that. No white bread.
There was no Skippy in your house?
There was no Skippy. There was no goober grape. But, I'd go to my friend's house and there'd be all this, this crap. That you don't get at home, so you want it.
Yeah, it must have seemed like a bountiful source of pleasure.
Right. So, we're talking
forbidden
about this
pleasure.
Now. Exactly. We're talking about, in retrospect, I ate very healthy and it was a very healthy environment to eat in and all that kind of stuff. But all I really wanted to do was have hot dogs and chocolate ice cream and shit. And, that wasn't happening very often.
Right. I bet you – did you have a TV?
We did not have a TV, though I used to go dumpster diving. There weren't dumpsters to dive in, but I'd go – I'd go rummaging, right?
And right, through the yeah. landfill or the dump.
Or go to the thrift store in the junk section and you could get stuff for nothing. And I think at one point I bought a TV set for like a dollar, like one of those little black and white,
sure.
with a 15-inch screen. And
right, and the big rabbit ears.
And made out of plastic. And, we're in the middle of rural Vermont, and this is before cable TV. And so I would like, play around with it. And I found, because we were quite far north in Vermont, I could get Canadian television. And then I could also get, I was able to get Second City TV somehow. And but the speaker didn't work very well, so I had to get a C-clamp and clamp a piece of wood onto the TV and squeeze the area where the speaker was to make it clear. So that was TV for me in my
That's
youth.
That's hilarious. Yeah. But also sounds like you were remarkably enterprising and handy, which came in handy when you're starting a restaurant.
Yeah, but I've always learned by doing or watching other people do. I was a voracious reader, but I was never able to really learn by reading. It was always something to do with watching somebody do it and then kind of obsessively do the same thing
right.
until I got it right.
So how did you make your way into the cooking and restaurant culture?
Mm. Well, growing up in rural Vermont, we were near Smuggler's Notch ski resort, which is on the opposite side of the mountain from Stowe and Mount Mansfield, right at the base of the tallest mountain in Vermont. And so there wasn't much work to be done in that town except to work either at the sawmill or a gas station or the ski resort. So my mom was a cook. She was cooking at a restaurant near the ski resort.
That was her day job.
That was her day job. And I would go there and hang out. And then when I needed to get a job, like a summer job, I ended up getting a job at the ski resort as a busboy and conference waiter and whatever, because I didn't want to work on the mountain. And from there, I got a job as a dishwasher at a place that my mom knew the sous chef there.
But you hate washing dishes.
Yeah, but I also like money, so it was great. It was good. It was like going to boot camp. I got a job as a dishwasher at a fondue restaurant, so you can imagine what that's like.
That's probably the worst place to be a dishwasher.
It was horrible. I'd be covered from head to toe with water, and I'd be scrubbing burned on cheese. And there was a chef there who was, horrible, horrible.
That's like
alcoholic.
Dishwasher purgatory.
Yeah, he'd be throwing frying pans across the kitchen and swearing at people. It was amazing.
So, but that was your job. And were you hooked by that?
No, it was still driven. This is really driven by practicality.
Got it.
And, I left home and I went to Vail, Colorado to go skiing. And once again, I was faced with, like, what am I going to do here for work? And the choices were, well, you could go to work in the front of the house and get a bunch of tips, maybe. And then you have to be, you know, have to keep yourself nice and neat and clean and speak nicely. And or you could work in the kitchen and they give you a free ski pass. So that was a no-brainer for me. I was like, I'll just stay in the kitchen. And it just kind of fell into it. It took a few years for me to kind of go, actually, you know, I actually kind of have a little bit of – I don't have talents that I have. I understand this, and I think I can do it well. And at some point, it all kind of gelled, and I was like, okay, I am a good line cook. I can do this.
Yeah, and so it almost became a craft you were going to master.
Yeah, I would call it a craft, or, you know, it's just a vocation. Being a line cook is a technical job. It's not a creative job, right? Mm-hmm. You're a craftsman at best, I would say. And a tradesman, you know, kind of if you're good at it.
But you were probably moving from the exotic life of a dishwasher in a fondue restaurant, because fondue is very gourmet.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, and then you were moved to a restaurant in Colorado as a dishwasher, probably where they probably didn't have fondue on the menu.
Well, actually, Vail at the time was run by the Austrians, Germans, and Swiss. So they absolutely had fondue restaurants. But my first job was at a place called the Bridge Street Deli. And if anybody was in Vail, Colorado, anywhere from the mid-60s to the early 80s, they would know Bridge Street Deli, because it was kind of the place, right, where you could get a simple meal. And it was run by Peter and Otto. And we made, you know, home fries and, you know, everything was cooked on a griddle.
From scratch.
From scratch. Everything was cooked on the grill from scratch, but, you know, the hamburger patties were frozen and fake butter whirl all over the place. So I just sit back there with my glasses on that would slowly get covered with grease, and I'd have to go and clean them and go back to the griddle. Yeah. Lots of grilled ham and cheeses and stuff like
that. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. And then you move from there to gradually more serious restaurants,
correct,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my next job was at a place that did prime rib. So it's a little step up the ladder.
Right.
Still run by Swiss and German guys and a crazy Austrian chef who used to scream obscenities and, you know, make me go to – he'd say, Andy, go to the liquor store, get me a bottle of brandy, and hurry up or else I've been lying underneath the table with my pants full of shit. That was what he would say. And bring me 2 lottery tickets and don't be a shoemaker.
And then you move from there to actually really serious restaurants eventually,
right?
Yeah,
eventually. Right? It took a while. You know, there was a series – you know, I left Vail. I went to California. I worked in kind of like a big Gino's East of Chicago, like a corporate
– pizza restaurant.
Pizza, Italian-y kind of place. And then I left L.A. to go traveling. And this is when my real culinary education started happening. I'd worked in a northern Italian place in Vail, too, which was kind of high pressure. But it was still fettuccine,
right,
and, you know, linguine and lasagna and stuff. When I started traveling, that's when my food education really started to kick off. I ended up living in New Zealand for a couple of years. I lived in Australia. I worked my way through, you know, all kinds of different food-related jobs. Ended up gaining some fine dining experience, but not much during that trip, mostly volume stuff. And then eventually I started, I came back to the United States, ended up back in Vail again. This time I ended up at a place called Sweet Basil, run by a chef of at the time of some renown. And that was my first real taste of getting my butt kicked by, you know, really good quality, high-end cooking. I've lost track of where I was when anymore. I think I might have put that out of sequence. That might have happened while I was still in Vail.
It happens when you get old, man.
Yeah, you slowly kind of build yourself your thing up, and then you know, I went back to England. I staged in Le Manoir Quatre Saisons.
It was a very famous 3-star,
yeah,
right?
Raymond Blanc, yeah, at the time, and that was just a huge eye opener. I just did it for like a, you know, it wasn't long. It was like a 5-day stint or something like that. But it really kind of opened my eyes, and went to a few other places in London for brief stages through a friend of mine who's a food purveyor there. And, you know, I've always kind of tried to move up. But it was still really just a vocation. It wasn't a passion.
Mm-hmm.
I did that so that I could do the other things that I like to do, which
still,
is travel.
Even when you're working at Raymond Blanc's restaurant.
Yeah, sure.
So, but it was eye-opening. Give us an example, even if it was still just a vocation. You know?
Yeah. So, you know, going and seeing how the brigade system worked, that was a big eye-opener to me. Like, and seeing kids, like 16-year-old kids who had traveled from the north of England to go and actually work, apprentice themselves there, the seriousness with which the food was approached, you know, was very eye-opening because my whole background had been kind of like the Tony Bourdain Kitchen Confidential thing where you need slinging stuff as fast as you can.
Right.
There is no glamour or glory in it whatsoever. To see it, the food treated with that kind of respect was really interesting.
Got it.
The whole time, this was still about traveling, rock climbing, which I was really into, fishing. Like the things that were more important to me were outside of work.
Right.
The work was a way to, because I had a skill that I could market. And it finally started changing a little bit for me when I landed in Portland. And I eventually got a job at a place called Zephyro. Now, Zephyro was probably the sort of the first truly modern restaurant in Portland where the folks who ran it had come from the Bay Area. They had worked at like Square One,
right.
Zuni Cafe, that kind of thing. It was very much of
Judy
that.
Rogers, Alice Waters, Jeremiah Tower.
Barbara, what's her name? I'm a terrible memory. It was too much pot when I was a kid. So there we were getting, farmers were showing up at the back door, right, with stuff. August rolled around and the tomatoes would come. The one guy that had the tomatoes and, you know, the guy from Neatarts Bay would show up with oysters. And this was a whole new thing for me. And there was no yelling going on in the kitchen. Nobody there was like a professional cook. These are all people who are like food people. And, you know, the chef was not even really – he's a chef. His name's Chris Israel. Very, very talented, great palate. But he didn't – you know, he didn't go through – he was like Joyce Goldstein's assistant or something at Square One. So it was a whole nother way of approaching food. Now that type of restaurant is pretty common where you have somebody who's just very talented who builds this kind of restaurant concept and empire afterwards.
Yeah. And so how and when did Thailand enter the picture?
Well, I was on this long trip, right? I'd left the United States. I'd left L.A. I was traveling. I'd lived in New Zealand, Australia.
So you never left your wanderlust behind?
No. This is, you know, we're backtracking now. We're going backwards. And this is way before Zephyro. So I ended up in Thailand the first time in 1987 as a backpacker and did the same thing most people did, ate at bungalows and whatnot. But it was really the culture is what got me the first time around. And the food was really great, but it wasn't about the food at that time. I went back again in 1992 after I'd been living in Portland for a little while, and I went to visit an old friend who was there. He had married a woman that he met while being a fellow at the university or something. He had a fellowship or something like that. They introduced me, his wife Locke introduced me to the local food, local seasonal regional food, which I had no idea existed, nor would there have been a way for me to know that eating in Thai restaurants in America. And that was what really kicked it off.
And that just blew you away. I mean, that blew your mind. And
you see those videos on YouTube of a guy running out of the side and, like, tackling somebody, right? it was like that. You know, basically, I just got blindsided, and it was the flavor of the food first, right? They took me to a place. I believe we were there in May. And this is the time of year when there's a certain type of mushroom that pops up, a wild mushroom called het top. And it looks like a puffball mushroom, but it's a little bit, it's darker in color and it's got a little bit of a bitter taste to it. And it's highly prized in northern Thailand. And so they make something called yam het top, which is basically a soup that involves sour leaves of the tamarind tree and some others, maybe pork ribs, these little mushrooms. And I tasted it and it knocked me out for several different reasons. Number one, it was unlike the flavor profile of anything I'd tasted that said Thai around it, right? So it was kind of bitter, sour, herbaceous, spicy, no coconut cream, nothing that we think of as Thai, right? No stir frying, just all everything's boiled. And we're eating it with sticky rice and a few, and like a nem prick, a pounded chili paste of some sort, local. And it was the flavors were unlike anything I'd had anywhere, let alone Thai food. And then they were like, yeah, we only make this time of year. I was like, okay, so that means that there's seasonal Thai food.
So the things you make in the other months,
right,
that I need to have.
And it's local because this is the only this is the place, you know, they only make it where this mushroom grows. And it's really, really specific because this guy makes his version. And I was like, wow, that means that if this is happening here, there's some dude, you know, in the next town over who's making this too, that's probably a little bit different. And that means that all over this country, similar stuff is happening.
Right.
So that kind of blew it all open for me.
Yeah.
I started to pursue that idea that that might be true. And lo and behold, it was.
A quick shout out to one of our sponsors who brings you this message. HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients, measured to the exact quantities needed to eliminate food waste, and offers step-by-step recipes for delicious meals designed to take around 30 minutes to make, all of which are approved by 2 registered dietitians on staff. New this spring, you can expect lighter fare and breakfast options, with each meal coming out to just under $10. And everything is delivered in a special insulated box, always with free shipping. For $30 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter the promo code SeriousEats30 when you subscribe.
We're talking with chef restaurateur Andy Ricker. In the book, you talk about it's like you realized you couldn't work in restaurants anymore, so you became a house painter.
That's right. Yeah, I remember at the time I was working at Zeffiro. I remember walking out into the dining room and just, you know, this is the best cooking job you could get in Portland, basically. I was the sous chef at this, you know, awesome restaurant. I remember walking out to the dining room and just like looking at all these people just kind of shoveling this food into their mouth. And, you know, it looked repulsive to me. And I knew that if people eating the food that I've been involved in making is repulsive to me, that I've got to get the hell out of the kitchen for a while, because
wow,
I just can't. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Why do you think at that moment it repelled you? Do you think it was because of the stark contrast to what you'd experienced in Thailand?
I think maybe it was just the conspicuous consumption aspect of it. People just like kind of, you know, spending all this money and jamming this food down their throats, and you know,
so you can't ever leave your hippie roots behind.
Yeah. Well, I have since, but yeah, it just really freaked me out. So I decided, okay, I'll go and do some bartending because I can, you know, I know I can do that and I can make some money and I won't have to think about cooking food for a while. So I did that for a while. And then I started just hating that too, because when you're a bartender, what's your number one issue? You're dealing with drunk people all the time. And I'm sorry, but drunk people are assholes, including me. So, you know, I just, you know, I wanted out of that too. And so there I was painting houses and I thought, I'll just do this for a summer. And then, you know, and I've got a couple of houses lined up. I'll do this. I'll play in my band. And lo and behold, you know, 2 months into it, I've got a crew of 8 guys. They're all musicians like me. And you know, I'm a full-time house painter.
Yeah, wait, we haven't even touched on the music. Like, what was the name of the band?
Oh, okay. Well, I was in a bunch of different bands in Portland in the early 90s all the way up through the early 2000s. I was in a bike messenger band. A band called Moxie Love Crux.
It was all bike messengers?
Except for me. but I rode my bike like a bike messenger. And I was in a band called 44 Long, another one called Vehicle, a bunch of other projects around town.
Sort of indie bands making
local no
records.
Money, local records, all that kind of stuff. It was a really interesting milieu to be in, though, in the early 90s, because there was Elliot Smith was there doing his thing.
And yeah, the Portland scene was really happening.
Really happening. A lot of those guys are still around, still making music, you know. Some have moved on to kind of really well-known bands.
Slater-Kinney,
The Decembrists, John Moen's in that one. There's just like a lot of guys that I you know, knew and played music with who – but then there's a certain number of them who just completely bailed out.
Right.
And are like, you know, software engineers or coffee
right.
roasters.
So you're playing your band, your house painting – with your crew,
mm-hmm.
and then you're just every
winter.
So you just go to Thailand.
Yeah, so you know the painting business is very cyclical. So in the wintertime, you know, A, it's too crappy out to paint the exterior and nobody wants you in their house because they're having holidays. So, you know, I would leave for November and December and January and go travel, usually to Thailand, and come back. And I'd done that a little bit before between restaurant jobs too. So, you know, I just started going again and again and again and again.
So you're going back and forth between house painting, and you come back to Portland, and you realize there's only so long you can paint houses without being driven insane.
Well, it was the same thing as with cooking.
Yeah,
you know, I would show up at the job site. I'd look at the wall, and I go, and I'd go, okay. I give some instruction and I'd bounce. You know, and I'd go bid another job, or I'd
you just
go sit in a cafe.
Out.
I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't face it. There really was only one other trade that I was, you know, proficient at, and that was cooking. And, you know, talk to any cook. They all think that they should have their own restaurant because they know how to do it better than the person they're working for or better than the people they've worked for. They think they've got it figured out. And I was exactly the same way. I was like, I'm going to open my restaurant, do it my way, blah, 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 all this shit. I didn't know, you know, I had no idea what it really meant to do
that.
But I also knew that I never wanted to work for for anybody else. I didn't want to punch anybody else's clock. Being, you know, self-employed for, you know, 8-9 years, it's really hard to go back to punching the clock.
It's funny you say that because, you know, I learned that in Serious Eats. It's like when I started Serious Eats, I didn't want any gatekeepers. I didn't want anyone telling me what to do.
Right.
Because I'd been a freelancer, and once you are an independent contractor, it's really hard to go back.
Very hard. So really the only thing – so you have this dream to open a restaurant, and you don't want to work for anybody else. So, you know, this seemed like the right time to pull the trigger.
Got it. But you talk in the book about a moment in Austin where you say that everything changed.
Yeah. And that was my really great friend, Ethan Azarian, who I grew up with more or less. Like we would go from Philadelphia to Vermont to see his family. His parents and my parents, you know, were in college folk music scene together. And Ethan's this fantastic artist, musician, hillbilly guy who I love. And we were staying at his house during South by Southwest playing music. The sink started leaking. I said, hey, Ethan, the sink's leaking. He walked in, looked at it, reached under the sink and yanked the P-trap right off the sink. Just pulled it like right out of the wall. I was like, what did you do that for? We could have. He's like, well, it's broken now and now the landlord has to fix it. And so it'll get done right.
That was like a cosmic truth for you.
It was. It was like, look, just yank the drain out of the wall and then you have to do something, right? So, you know, I kind of pursued that in various different ways till I was able to open a restaurant.
First of all, it wasn't really a restaurant. So let's talk about that, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was filled with drama and adventure, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, basically I was in Portland. I was looking for a place to do this, but I wanted to own the space because that's a smart thing to do is own property. So I found a place and, you know, it was an old turn of the century farmhouse with like a little sushi shack out in front. And I managed to make a deal. I paid a lot of money for it. We were kind of in the middle of a little housing bubble at the time. It was a great investment nonetheless. But, you know, I went in there and my friend and I showed my friends what I was going to do. And they're like, you're crazy. This is never going to work. You know, I went for it anyway. There was a year of just intense.
You were in hock.
Yeah. I took a second mortgage out on my house. I applied for a loan. They said no, but then they gave me a credit card with a $50,000 limit. And I was like, oh, you can get credit cards. This was the time when you could just get a credit card by burping, you know, and they just give you one. So, you know, I applied for like 3 or 4 credit cards and maxed them all out at the same time so they wouldn't have time to catch up to my game.
Interesting approach to starting a restaurant.
And then you do the thing where you transfer the balance from one to another, just kind of staying ahead of it. They'd pay each other off.
You became a master of that game?
Well, I don't know if I became a master because they started coming after me. They're like, hey, man, you got to pay up sort of thing. And the restaurant, you know, opened and, you know,
And it was really a takeout joint. It wasn't really a restaurant.
It was a shack next to a house and had a little commercial kitchen in the basement. We had this little shack, had a little grill out back. And you know, it's, you know, it was scary because, you know, the first month it was just like nobody came. And I was just sitting out there freezing cold in this shack kind of selling to a few people. But then it took off. And then that got scary because I had these big lines of people. And I was trying to build the actual restaurant in the house. So I was like working. I'd get up in the morning at like 6 in the morning, go prep, get ready for lunch, burn through lunch. We'd break for like an hour and a half or 2 hours in the middle of the day. Then we, you know, we'd prep like crazy, be ready for the evening. And then we work until like 8:30 or 9. And then I'd, you know, we'd clean up and then I'd bounce back into the house and I'd do some carpentry.
Jesus.
I was living in the house by then as well.
One of the things that you said in the book, you said, I wouldn't call the place a Thai restaurant. If I did, people would show up expecting pad thai and cashew chicken, hardly standard operating procedure for a first-time chef restaurateur.
Yeah. I mean, we in America, when you say authentic traditional Thai restaurant, the thought that comes to mind is what, you know, what we're used to as far as Thai food. And I, you know, initially when Pok Pok opened, number one, I didn't want to be nailed with that because of the, you know, the trap of calling yourself authentic and traditional is multifold. You know, then you're like, well, you got to have the pad thai and the cashew chicken. Plus, you're a white dude. How dare you claim tradition and authenticity? And third of all, I didn't plan on just making Thai food. We had food from all of my travels. I'd been in Malaysia a bunch, Indonesia, Vietnam, Southern China, all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, I wanted to put that stuff on the menu too, which I did.
Yeah. And you say that eventually people started coming and you say that customers embraced the food with so much fervor you think I was serving cupcakes. But as I found out with Serious Eats, being beloved doesn't mean being successful.
True. Yeah. It was scary. Like for the very first time in my life, I had to call my mom and ask her for a loan to pay the payroll. One time, and it
never
was
a good situation.
Yeah, it was really. I felt, you know, my mom is of very limited means, and like she was digging into her savings to give this to me. But something happened, which was that a food critic at the Oregonian at the time, Karen Brooks. It was the Oregonian.
She just won the James Beard Award.
And she just won a James Beard Award. I just saw her the other night. She was giddy. It was great. She named us Restaurant of the Year. And this was 2007 or 2008. I can't recall which one. We opened in 2005, by the way, just the shack. And, you know, basically overnight, there was this whacking great line out in front of the restaurant. And, you know, then we had a whole other kind of problem to deal
with. Right.
Yeah.
Getting all those people food.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
As soon as we got the lines, I was able to start paying back all this money that I'd borrowed and,
right,
you know, favors I'd taken from friends and stuff like
that. It's truly a terrifying thing what you're describing because I can relate to it so much because so many of those things happened with Serious Eats too.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people who understand what it's like to have the gun that close to your temple are people who have done it. And they don't have to have done it in the same business, but every person who starts a business faces those months or moments.
Right. And for me, it was what I felt like then was, this is it. I don't really have the means to do this again. This is it. This is do or die. If this doesn't work, I'm going to go back to being a painting contractor and, you know, just kind of lick my wounds and figure this out. But luckily it worked.
Right. It worked. And you know, and you became a James Beard Award winner. I want you to come back, if you wouldn't mind, because I do want to get into some of the things we haven't had a chance to get into. So we can talk about the book and the pitfalls of epitomizing Thai food as a non-Thai person.
I'd be happy to. Thanks, Ed.
And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.